Welcome back to The Daily Drum on WHUR and Sirius XM Channel 141. This is the Inside segment. I'm Harold Fisher. Since the COVID-19 pandemic first struck the U.S., there's been widespread criticism of how the federal government has handled the crisis. Even as most states across the nation begin to open up this week, questions remain about what the Trump administration is doing to stem the tide of the coronavirus pandemic. Well, tonight, we're asking, how would you grade the government's response? And what needs to be done, if anything, to improve it? My guests are Dr. Kenesha Grant, political science professor here at Howard University, and retired Lieutenant General Russell Honoré, former commander of Joint Task Force Katrina. Of course, you remember during the Hurricane Katrina disaster back in 2005 in southern Louisiana. Lines are open. Give us a call at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. Tweet us using the hashtag WHURFM. General Honoré, Dr. Grant, thanks for joining me. I appreciate it.
Thanks for having us.
Welcome.
Thank you. General Honoré,
well,
let me...
Much.
Absolutely, sir. Let me first start with you, General Honoré, on A, B, C, D, or F. How would you grade the government's response, the federal government's response to this COVID-19 pandemic in the U.S. and why?
A D minus. We still have 2,000 people dying a day plus. We have not optimized the Defense Production Act. We don't have a national strategy for testing, and we don't have a national strategy for logistics, which day by day draws out as the pandemic spread across the nation, that while people up front focus on the peak and the wave and bringing the death toll down, which at one time was up to 3,000 a day, and now it's on average 2,000 a day, we are losing this war. And the point in context is, in a real disaster, you lose the first half. And I think the government lost the first half, first by denying that when this thing was in China and then showed up in Washington, that it was a disaster. They dealt with it as a hoax. They were in denial. So the White House was slow, and they were not decisive in ensuring the test kits were ready with the CDC and that the national stockpile was ready to go based on lessons that were being learned in China. So we were slow and not decisive, and in some ways sent bad messaging out that it was a hoax designed with a political objective as opposed to what we knew about pandemics and the dangers that it could pose if it got into our society. And it's happened. And right now, we're in the first half of this fight, and we're losing. When you lose 2,000 people a day, that's equivalent to what we lost in all of Katrina. That's almost equivalent to what we lost in 9/11. That's about half of what we lost in Pearl Harbor when we went to war over. The White House talk about this being a war. They're not acting like it's a war. They're acting like it's a response to an economic condition. This is a public health emergency, and they're trying to balance this with the economic emergency and with a reelection campaign. So the messages have been mixed, and what they say is not matched with what's happening on the ground. The White House has said they've got testing resource. They don't. They've left it up to each state to go out and find the logistics they need. The White House say they have PPE solved. They don't. Each state is still competing for resources. And in the short term, that's why they get this grade.
Dr. Grant, let me ask you the same question. A through F, what would you give the administration? And politically, from your perspective, why?
I will give them an F. They remind me of the students, no Howard students, of course, but the students who refused to do any work in the first I don't know, have three quarters of the semester and hope that it's possible to bring it home at the end of the semester and are not prepared to do so.
With extra credit.
with extra credit, not realizing I already gave you extra points. And so I think that this administration deserves an F. I think the general laid out a wonderful and very detailed case about all the things that went wrong or have been going wrong. But I think I would just add to that, you need your political leaders to be thinking about contingencies that you don't have enough information to think about. Part of the reason we have a representative government, in addition to this idea that we might not be able to hear all the voices if we're all thinking and talking at the same time, is that we expect some people to have dedicated expertise in things. I can't be a professor and have deep and intense knowledge about how viruses affect respiratory systems. We depend on doctors to do that. And so to the extent that this administration decided not to spend money to keep its pandemic task force, decided over and over again to whittle away at the various parts of the federal government that make it work in the name of, quote unquote, draining the swamp, we are seeing those things come to fore now. Some of the things that the federal government does when we're not paying attention happen because there are contingencies that we can't imagine. And so it's important for a president, a presidential candidate, people in the executive branch, the administration, et cetera, to be thinking about those things in advance, because we can't often do that. In terms of their politics, I have to give them another F. I think that the president doesn't recognize that there is more to reelection than the economy. The ability to get to work is important, and I understand that we have varying kinds of relationships to work. I know that people are suffering, they're losing jobs, but I think that for many of us, it's more important, dare I say most of us, it's more important to be alive the next day than to have money. So I didn't grow up with a bunch of money, and so maybe there's a piece of this that I don't understand, but I was always taught that as long as I got my health, I can do something else later. Being poor kills you in different ways, but I think a virus in this instance is something that is driving the president's, or the economy is driving the president's behavior in ways that I don't think make sense. Americans are not going to be okay if the economy is doing okay or not good or even good, but people are dying one after the other. And so I think to the extent that he won't cooperate with Democrats or won't make decisions that are in the best interest of the health of the citizens and residents of this nation, he deserves an F.
202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. We are talking about the government response to the COVID-19 pandemic. What do you think about it? And what needs to be done to perhaps make it better? 202-319-7810. 202-319-7810. General, some 48 states last week began the process of opening up. Just today, Maryland Governor Larry Hogan announced that the phase one process is going to begin on Friday. Virginia's Governor Ralph Northam echoed the same, and with the exception of some pockets, some hotspot counties, for example, the states are going to be able to open up. What are your thoughts about that process operationally? Is that the right thing to do?
Well, my expertise is in command, control, and logistics. And
yes,
I've
sir.
Done it from planning on the Joint Chiefs of Staff. I used to attend White House meetings in the Situation Room dealing with these type of events. Nothing on the scale of a pandemic inside the United States that's causing so much death. But that's why we used to meet in the National Security Council. I believe that what they're doing is contrary to the experts in the medical field, the public health people, because they have not put public health first. Even the most respected person on this topic that people shoot at from all directions, Dr. Fauci, has said he doesn't think that the states are ready to be opening at the pace they're open. I'm not a medical expert, but I listen to what he says. I listen to other experts who come on television, and I think we may be doing this without sufficient testing, tracing, and containing. And until those instruments get put in place, I think we are opening too fast, opening at the request and the pressure from the people to want to open businesses back up. But we can see examples. Again, I'm not the medical expert. I'm a command and control and logistics person. If you don't have those pieces in place, premature opening could make things a lot worse for us as we go into the fall and get into the flu season and cold weather set in, and we could have another spike like we did in the opening days in early mid-March in the United States. So I go with Dr. Fauci, who says we don't think all these states and all these locations are ready because we have not set the preconditions for success, which is test kits, test, 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 and attack and tracing and following up on people. We just saw an example in Korea where they opened the bars, and on one weekend they had another spike. Mm. Why? Because you can't social distance in a bar. That's my long answer. I'm sorry for such a long answer.
No, that's quite all right. We have time, and I appreciate your expertise in this regard. One of the things, you know, Dr. Grant, that I found fascinating during the press conference that the president had, I believe this was on Monday, and we've kind of seen these things happen before where he is pressed to answer questions about what is happening with the pandemic. There was his comment towards Weijia Chang, the CBS News correspondent, talking about asking China about it. It seems another attempt to deflect. And even more broadly, there was all of these announcements about how well the country is doing with testing. And yet Mitt Romney, the senator from Utah, during the hearing yesterday, did a really clap back, saying that, you know, the comparison was inaccurate. Why do you believe that the president is either trying to throw out these shiny objects or make these comparisons between what is happening here and in other countries?
I think that the president has a few things going on. I think the president believes that it is absolutely necessary to be on TV often to help his reelection attempt. I don't think that he recognizes how being on television and not having a command of the situation actually puts him in a worse position than not being on television at all. So I think that is a part of the problem. It's clear that he doesn't take the time to understand what the experts are telling him. It's clear that he doesn't think deeply about the information that he comes into contact with. And so I think that's kind of chief among his problems.
Go ahead.
I think the other issues that he has,
Dr. Grant, can you hear me?
Yes, I can hear you.
Yeah, please. You said the other issues that he has. Please continue.
I think the other issues that he has are to do with kind of a warped sense of how our society works. And so one of the things that has been very difficult to watch, as you mentioned, is his treatment of reporters, like historically, but certainly in this time. If he's going to go through the work of being on television every day and having these press conferences and pretending to care about what's happening and pretending to share information with people about what's happening, it's necessary to treat the press, these people who are leaving their homes in spite of all this destruction of health every day, with a bit of respect, to expect that they are going to ask questions that are going to get to some answers that we need to understand exactly how the world works.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that we historically that we learned when it comes to presidents and the press, even though the media is going to do what it's going to do, a charm offensive does not hurt. We saw John F. Kennedy do that. We've seen Barack Obama do that. We've seen Ronald Reagan do that. Maybe there's a lesson to be learned as it relates to dealing with the media. We're going to take a break, but when we come back, I want to talk a little bit more about this process, leadership, contrasting and comparing the tragedy, the situation in New Orleans back in 2005 with Hurricane Katrina, and what's happening now. We're going to continue that conversation with General Honore as well as Dr. Kenesha Grant. So please stay with us. If you have a comment or a question, give us a call. Lines are still open at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. The original Quiet Storm is next on WHUR. This conversation continues on Sirius XM, channel 141. In just a few seconds, we'll be right back. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. Tonight we're asking, how would you grade the government's response to the coronavirus pandemic and what needs to be done, if anything, to improve it? My guests are Dr. Kenesha Grant, political science professor at Howard University, and retired Lieutenant General Russell Honore, former commander of Joint Task Force Katrina, of course, during the Hurricane Katrina disaster back in 2005. Lines are still open if you have a comment or question at 202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. General Honore, one of the things that struck me about you during the Hurricane Katrina disaster, and some could argue that this was a watershed moment for you, is when you took over, one of the first things that you were seen and heard saying to the troops under your command was, put down your guns, and I'm paraphrasing here, these are American citizens, these are not our enemies. And that was a humanitarian demonstration, I would argue, for leadership and how to deal with a disaster, a crisis, because we are talking about people. From your perspective, what is the best humanitarian approach to deal with this pandemic here in the United States?
Is to prioritize the function of saving lives. In any disaster, the number one priority has to be saving lives. And when politicians do not emphasize that, then it's apparent that they focus on other things is not the number one thing that we collectively as a people over 238 years now committed to government, to be working in the government, to live by a constitution, live by the laws. So when something happened, the government is there with the number one priority to save lives. You know, there were some people after Katrina who wanted to worry about looting and securing the city. And the emphasis was saving lives, not securing the city. We need to get people out of here. We need to keep them alive. And that was the emphasis I tried to bring as the military leader on the ground, that the priority is saving lives. It's not about guns. It's not about crime. It's about saving lives.
Dr. Grant, one of the things that we are now already seeing in political ads is the discussions about leadership, whether it's Joe Biden, who is the presumptive Democratic nominee, or, you know, or the president. We saw that that something that looked like a political ad, I believe it was last month, during the coronavirus task force meeting. And I'd love to get your perspective on, as we move closer towards the general election in November, how might this impact that election, whether it be for Donald Trump or even Joe Biden? Could it swing both ways, or could this be Donald Trump's Waterloo?
I think that's a great question, and I think that it has two parts. I think the first part is about the actual campaign, and I think the second part is about turnout. But let me talk about the campaign part first. We think, political scientists at least think, and I think politicians follow this, that people respond better to fear and worry than they do to anything else. There's a little bit of excitement and happiness and hope out of 2008 that really mobilized people. But when you think about campaign ads and you think about the way that politicians interact with folks, you see so many negative and dark campaign ads, because when we run experiments, people seem to be paying the most attention when they are afraid. And so I think that you should absolutely expect that the president of the United States is going to be running ads that make you kind of worried. If you are potentially open to messages from the president, and they're going to open up a spirit of worry in you and then try to insert some feeling of calm, insert the idea that he is the person who can help you through this tough time. And so I think that he'll be talking about the economy. I think it'd be foolish for him to talk about it in terms of its gains without talking about the fact that the economy took a big hit. And so maybe he'll position himself as the person who can save the economy or some other kind of thing. But I think for sure you should expect that he'll be talking about, he'll have a very dark campaign, would be my guess. For Joe Biden, I don't think that he can really do that. I don't think that he can do that and win. I don't think he can do it and win for one reason, because he doesn't have the levers of power at his disposal right now. He is not the president. And so he can't say what he will do to help the American people. He can only talk about what he might do if he was elected to office. He's not currently in office, and so he always has to be careful about the way that he does that. But I think the other thing is the message that's going to work for the Democratic voter has to be a bit more hopeful, because they are dealing with all the stress of these health challenges. They're dealing with the stress of the economy, and they're dealing with all the memories of the other parts of the Trump presidency. We're in a pandemic, so it's kind of, not only are we in a pandemic, but there's so much mess in the Trump presidency that it's easy to lose sight. But it's been a long, hard road. He got impeached, which is something that we don't talk about anymore because we're talking about the coronavirus, but he got impeached. He had these sexual assault charges. We're still unclear about where his money is going, whether he has any dealings with Russia. Like, all of these things are in the minds of Democratic voters. And so I think that they already are full of the fear thing. I don't think they need more of that. And so I would expect that Joe Biden will continue this language about leadership, continue talking about hope and change and things that make people feel good as a way to get them turned out. Now, both parties have to make decisions about how they're going to navigate the election in November. We see the Republicans pivoting towards trying to make it required for people to show up and vote in person. We see that the Democrats are gesturing towards this idea that it's a good idea to have mail-in ballots, but not full-on saying that they don't want to have in-person voting. And so I think the second piece is going to be really important, is the turnout piece. Which one of these parties is going to be able to get those votes into the hands of the secretaries of state, no matter what the situation is with this pandemic?
202-319-7810, 202-319-7810. General Honoré, if you were asked by this administration to come out of retirement to assist in managing this crisis, would you?
That's a good question. Right now, I'm an at-risk, vulnerable person because of my age and health. But I would not say outright no. But let me step back a minute.
Sure.
And say this. We've got an election coming up. We have to get young people to go vote. Those who are old enough and those who are in the workforce and those in college. The young people voted at a rate of about 30%. We've got to make sure, and this big voice you have on Howard, HBCU Sirius Radio, we've got to get and repeat the message of the importance of people getting up and going vote and take somebody with you. It will all be for naught if this election come up and the young people don't show up And a lot of the elder people are going to be scared to go to the polls. The young people have to go vote. We've got to do better than 30%. And if they don't win the Senate, turn over the Senate, and win the White House, we're still going to be punching with one arm and hopefully hold on to the House. So I would say people need to ask in the back of their mind, what would Dr. King do? We need us another Dr. King. But there are thousands of them out there that need to speak up and act politically and become politically active. We've got to get out on the street and get people to vote and inspire people to vote, that they don't give up on government because we are watching bad government in action. If they don't vote, it won't matter. Nothing we say or do will matter if they don't go vote and change this government out. It'll be four more years of worse than what we have it now. And that's all I got to say about that, as far as Gump would say.
Mm-hmm. One of the things that struck me early in the conversation, and I do think that the president is correct when he says this is a war, and you kind of echoed that in using that, you know, the metaphor. And you're a soldier. But soldiers, and, you know, I come from a military family. Dad was an officer, grandfather in the Pacific Theater, and a grandfather in the European Theater during World War II. And one of the things that, you know, they often talked about was, you know, chain of command. In this particular war, don't we need to know who's in charge? And wouldn't you say, General, that we really don't have a clear understanding of who's in charge? I'm not necessarily talking about commander-in-chief, but I'm talking about clear-eyed, flat-footed messaging and directions for this war.
Well, absolutely. You know, if this was a shooting war and the enemy came on our shores or off our shores and killed 2,000 people a day, you would see the entire Department of Defense being used to fight this war. But this is a different kind of war, and it's killing 2,000 people a day, and we have not used all the instruments of power that's available to the president to help contain, to isolate, and to deal with this virus. We've used about 40,000 National Guard, who are the command of the governors, and we've used somewhere around 5,000 to 6,000 federal troops in support. But if it was a war, we would have deployed divisions and armies and corps. We only have a little over 125,000 of the million-plus military people deployed overseas. The purpose of our military is to defend the United States of America against all enemies, foreign and domestic. I do think he could optimize the logistics expertise of the military by appointing a four-star general who's in command. That admiral is a staff officer. He's not a commander. He don't command troops. He commands the Medical Service Corps. So that is an instrument that I think that could make a difference in acquiring the logistics needed for testing, the logistics needed for PPE, and we have our own airplanes inside the military to distribute them. Now, the military day job is to protect the country. But if you're losing 2,000 citizens a day, that's what they need to be working on. That's why we exist as a military, to defend the people of the United States. Over the years, we've gotten comfortable with sending troops all over the world to defend over there. We need to defend here, and there are a lot of instruments of power we're not using because the president has downplayed the significance of this pandemic, and people should not become comfortable with this virus killing 2,000 people a day. We cannot get comfortable with that number. And very seldom in the news today, it's the headline. It's not the headline in most news I've watched, 2,000 or so dead today. We are becoming conditioned that this is kind of okay and we're going to open up the economy. I think the president's priority has been to win the election at all costs, and anything that helped him do that, it's about him. It's not about saving lives and public health. Public health has to be number one.
I need to take a quick break, but when we come back, I'm going to talk about the perception versus reality, and at what cost do we open up the country moving forward? We'll be back in just a moment. Stay with us. Welcome back to The Daily Drum on Sirius XM, Channel 141. I'm Harold Fisher. We are talking about the government response to the COVID-19 pandemic. Dr. Grant, we've spoken a lot about the federal government response. This is specifically for you since you are here in the DMV. Maryland announced that it is going into phase one on Friday. Virginia also doing the same. D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser says not yet. How would you rate the responses for the DMV?
I think the DMV is doing better than the federal government, at least. I was in Florida when all of this happened and got to see some of how Florida was dealing with this, and it was very lax. And we ended up deciding to come back to Washington because we had a feeling that the government here was better equipped to do it. So I was very happy today to see the mayor's proclamation that the city will remain closed through June 8th, and to see that the governors of Virginia and Maryland have given the counties around the D.C. area the ability to be different from the rest of the state in their handling of it. And so I think that they are certainly engaging experts and thinking about ways that they can be prepared for what might happen. Another thing that's interesting is in the D.C. Convention Center, they've converted that to a hospital under the assumption that there may be a spike in cases at some point in the next few weeks. So I certainly, as a resident of D.C., feel like my government here is doing all the things it can do in order to keep me safe.
Mm-hmm. Are there acceptable losses in this war, General Honore? And I ask that because even as we open, and Dr. Anthony Fauci, the infectious disease expert, says that as we begin to open up, that there will be more infections and more deaths, and it seems that we are going forward anyway. But no one seems to be talking about this phrase, acceptable losses, as the United States attempts to repair its economy.
I don't think we could put people's lives with 2,000 dying a day on something based strictly on the economy. I know if people are listening and they don't have a job and they're having to go to a food bank or to get a SNAP program for food and don't know how to go. That's a level of pain that the legislature in Washington and the governors are going to have to deal with. How do we keep people functional so they can take care of their health and have food and electricity and a place to stay? That work must be done. Simultaneously, I don't think in a public health crisis there's an acceptable number, like 2,000 dead a day is acceptable so we can open the economy. You know, at the beginning of this crisis, I did interviews on Fox News and on CNN. Mm-hmm. And at that time, the Wall Street went crazy in the opening days. Wall Street, for some reason, now is at one of its highest levels because of the amount of money the feds have put into it to stabilize it. Nobody's talking about that. The one percenters who own and have money in Wall Street, they want to see the stock market high. They're not having any pain. And when they went up and down up front, I told them they need to steady themselves until we get control of this virus. I think the fact that Wall Street and stocks are carrying so high right now, they're not feeling the pain of the poor, and they're not recognizing the fact that we got 2,000 people dying a day. President Eisenhower, when they were considering the D-Day landing, suspected some 3,000 people would die. I think that number came out to about 2,500. But it took 9,000 casualties. You do that in a shooting war. But to transgress that to a public health emergency that says, and who's dying? Mm-hmm. A lot of the elderly and the poor are dying. People in nursing homes, people who are in jails, people who are in state-run veterans homes, and people, essential workers who drive buses and trucks and work in hospitals, they're taking the biggest hit. They're not a part of the 1%. They don't own stock. They work for $10.50 a day. We've got garbage truck workers going in New Orleans making $10.50 an hour. This week went on strike. Guess what they did? They fired them.
Wow.
In the middle of a pandemic. And there's nobody on the street marching for those people. We've got to have a social uprising akin to what Dr. King did, raising this country's voice up. Because if we don't speak up, everybody think we accept it. If we walk past this mistake, we've just set a new standard. If we accept this as 2,000 a day, it's the price to open the economy. And when he opened this economy, it's going to go back up, I would think, maybe to 3,000 a day. We cannot get comfortable with that. People need to start speaking up. Those of us with jobs or with financial security, we cannot let the poor people with no voice take this hit, and the elderly in nursing homes and those in prison and those who are working frontline jobs in the food chain, in butchers, in the slaughterhouses, take this hit. We've got to speak up. They don't have a voice. Mm. We've got to give them a voice, and people need to be prepared to go vote and change this government.
And speaking of speaking up for a segment of the community, Dr. Grant, perhaps never before has the black community received a wake-up call about whether it's, you know, health or politics, or can I say the politics of health. From your perspective, what is the message for the black community during this pandemic and looking forward?
I think there are probably a few messages. One of the messages is that we can't afford to sit out of the political arena. And so the general keeps begging folks, and I think I want to echo that, to make sure that you participate, because if you don't participate, we get a government anyway. And so it's our responsibility to try to suss out who's going to be the person who is going to protect our interests at the federal level, but also at the state and local level. There will be other elections that are happening other than the presidential election. And we get to see in the worst way possible what the consequences are for those elections. If it had been the case that the president had boots on the ground in China when this virus first emerged, all of the things that we have experienced might be different. And the adage goes that when America gets the cold, black folks get the flu. I think that we can expect, and I would suggest that this uncovers that that remains true and probably will continue to be true. When folks are talking about, or politicians are talking about, reopening the government, this reopening the government is going to have, the reopening society is going to have a disproportionate impact on us. There are many people in the society who can afford to stay home, who have stockpiles of leave or trust funds or other kinds of financial protections that many folks in the black community do not have. And so I think if there's anything to be aware of, it's to be aware that there are many people in this society who have a bunch of money, who care most about that money and will use that money to protect themselves over everything else. And that we can't depend on the government to take care of us, because it does not always work that they will do that. In some instances, in many instances, they're going to choose to protect this economy. They're going to choose to protect individuals who look like them, who run in their circles, and all these other kinds of things that we might not be able to do.
And I have one more minute left before I close out. And General Honoré, I just wanted to say we cannot end this conversation without saluting the U.S. Army Corps of Engineers and the work that they have done building these hospitals, these MASH units, for lack of a better term, in New York and in the Washington Convention Center and in the Baltimore Convention Center and other parts. Just a few words about, you know, what your guys and gals have done in uniform during this time.
Well, I'm so proud of our people in uniform, both active duty, the Guard and the Reserve. When called upon, they showed you what they could do. Imagine if you had turned PPE and testing over to those type generals.
How about that?
Okay. We have seen what right looked like. We have seen the power of our military. You saw it in action. Imagine if the Defense Logistics Agency and the Army Materiel Command and the Air Force Materiel Command was in charge of acquiring and distributing PPE. That would not be a problem, and you would have test kits, because we have run a global supply and logistics system, and we know how to do this. We've asked the government in Washington, the CDC, to deal with 50 states simultaneously. It's above their capacity. We know how to do this. The Corps engineers showed what they could do, but
yes,
imagine
sir.
If we had used the great power of these uniformed services to take over the supply, logistics, and the distribution of the kits to the governors and the National Guard to get the testing started, we would not be in the condition we are today. And if we don't use that instrument, I think we're going to go from 2,000 a day to 3,000 a day, and we're going to go into the fall maybe with 4,000 to 5,000 a day. I hope it doesn't happen.
I hope not.
But I listen to Dr. Fauci. I don't think we're ready.
Dr. Kenesha Grant, Lieutenant General Russell Honoré, retired Army, thank you so much for your time, sir. And thank you so much for your time, Dr. Grant. We appreciate it. Be safe. That is the Daily Drum for this Thursday, May 13th. I'm Harold Fisher. Now stay tuned for The Connection. Good night.